This is Kathleen Stevenson for the Friday Radio Zine. I'm speaking with Anne Fagan Ginger. She is a lawyer, retired, taught at 5 law schools, discovered the field of peace law, author of numerous books and articles, has an extensive background. She is in Portland for the National Lawyers Conference and will be speaking at it in various events. She will be part of a panel on human rights in Katrina late Friday afternoon. And that law conference happens, that National National Lawyers Guild conference happens at the Benson Hotel. You could probably call the Benson Hotel for more information on that. Her latest book is Challenging U.S. Human Rights Violations Since 9/11, and we are going to be talking about that and what it might mean for the future. I want to welcome Anne Fagan Ginger to KBOO. Thanks for coming in today.
Very glad to be, there is such a station. Glad to be here.
Can you talk about how this book came about, Challenging U.S. Human Rights Violations Since 9/11?
Well, it's like many books that happen. If you run an institute that's concerned about human rights, you get hundreds of emails, and then you read the newspapers. And then we also publish something called Human Rights Organizations and Periodical Directory. So all of the organizations and periodicals that are dealing with human rights send us their newsletters. And pretty soon you notice that there's a pile. And you see that there are major violations in a way that has never happened before in my life. Violations of human rights. And I lived through McCarthyism, and I represented witnesses before the Ohio Un-American Activities Commission, and I did many kinds of work fighting against deportations in the McCarthy period, and this is worse. And so when you have this huge pile, you want to say, what can we do about it? So eventually you divide it into categories, and then you start talking about it. And in this case, we found that we collected 180 reports. And one report may be about 500 people or 1,000 people, but we collected 180 reports of clear violations of human rights law since 9/11 by the U.S. government. And when you have this much material and you want to do something to stop it, then you put it in a book. That's what we did.
And the categories that you divided it into, roughly, what are they?
Well, broadly speaking, there are 30 categories. 11 are rights of the people that are being violated, and 19 are duties of the government that they are failing to fulfill. And the approach is that the rights and duties, the rights of the people and the duties of government, are set forth in certain documents. And one of those is called the U.S. Constitution, and one is called the U.N. Charter. And a lot of people in Berkeley, and I therefore assume the same is true in Portland, are not aware that the U.N. Charter is a treaty. A treaty is something signed by the President of the United States, ratified by 2/3 of the Senate, and under the U.S. Constitution, Article 6, Clause 2, it is the supreme law of the land, so that the U.N. Charter is the law of the city of Portland. It's the law of the state of Oregon, and it is the law of the United States, whether Bush and company understand that or not. And so we found that there were violations of the U.S. Constitution and of the U.N. Charter. And then just to make it easier or more difficult for them, whatever you want to say, there are also three treaties we've ratified that have gotten virtually no media coverage. One is called the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, ratified at the request of George Bush the First in 1992. And the other two are a convention on the elimination of all forms of racial discrimination, and one is the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment. Well, these three treaties are also the supreme law of the land. And what you learn by working on UN treaties is that you don't do everything by suing the bastards, going to court. That isn't how the UN operates. These committees, they establish a committee to enforce a treaty, and the committees use something which we might call the mobilization of shame. So they require that you make a report. So when the U.S. ratified these treaties, they were agreeing to make a report on their violations and enforcement of the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the Convention Against Racial Discrimination, the Convention Against Torture. And so the idea of filing reports with the State Department and the State Department filing reports with the U.N. committees is fundamental since 1992, whether the State Department remembers it or not. And so for us to collect all this material, it would be natural to make it into a report, which is what we did.
Mm-hmm. And so the book itself constitutes that report.
It is, and it has 180 reports in it, as I said, of these various kinds of violations. And then it contains a series of ordinances passed by cities and states against the Patriot Act, against other specific actions of the U.S., against the war in Iraq and so forth, so people can see what to do. And then Chapter 6 contains the language of the U.S. Constitution, the U.N. Charter, the Nuremberg Principles, and these three treaties, so people can see exactly how it all fits together.
So tell us something about these violations. How can we understand them? Are they all over the place? Are they concentrated in certain areas? How do you go about talking about the violations that are contained in this?
Well, we didn't do it geographically. We did it by substance. So the rights. The first one is the right not to be killed or disappeared. And the first case in the book, each one is numbered. So report 1.1 is about a man from Pakistan who came to the United States in the 1980s and sought political asylum, because if he'd stayed in Pakistan, he would have been killed. And he married a U.S. citizen. They had a couple of citizen children, and he kept applying for political asylum, and then he moved from one state to another, and no hearing was held. Finally, after 9/11, the government went after him and said that he was up for deportation. He said, but I have a political asylum application pending. So while the day that his political asylum application was to be decided, he was being detained by immigration. And in due course, he was deported. And a month after he was deported to Pakistan, his political asylum was granted. The only trouble was he'd been murdered 2 weeks before, which is what he was afraid of. And that's just the first of about 10 examples of the right not to be killed or disappeared. Then two is the right not to be tortured. And that is true all across the United States, and it is true in Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. And we say specifically that the United States government is in charge of the territory of Guantanamo. Certainly Cuba is not in charge. The United Nations is not in charge. The United States is in charge. And if Cuba tried to do anything in that territory, they'd be prevented from doing it. We are in charge. Well, when you're in charge of an area, you have to provide due process. And if you look in the first 10 amendments, it doesn't say this applies to citizens only. And so when it says in the Constitution itself that the right to habeas corpus shall not be lifted except in case of civil war or invasion, and neither of that has happened, that doesn't say it only applies to people born and bred in the United States. It applies wherever the U.S. has power. And so that's a fundamental concept in this book. And the third right is the right to be treated fairly, equally, regardless of race, religion, or gender, or disability. The right to travel. All these basic rights, the right of a librarian not to say which books you took out, the right of a journalist to publicize, to collect information and report it without being killed. I mean, it's pretty basic. And then the duties of the government, the first duty is to tell the truth to the people, which is not what has been happening. And the second duty is to conduct elections fairly. And the third duty that we've listed, these are not necessarily in order of importance, is to obey the law. And one of the things very few people in Portland know, and very few people in Berkeley, as a matter of fact, there is something called the International Court of Justice. It's one of the organs of the UN, just like the Security Council. But with all due deference to KABU, most of the media has not reported on the International Court of Justice. But in 1996, the World Court ruled, it's called the International Court of Justice or the World Court. The World Court ruled unanimously on something. And that means that the judge on that court from the United States, the judge from the United Kingdom, the judge from France, the judge from China, and the judge from Russia, the five nuclear weapons countries, all have permanent members on the International Court of Justice. And they were asked a question by the General Assembly, are nuclear weapons legal or illegal? And they ruled unanimously that nuclear weapons are illegal. And they ruled unanimously that there is a duty to negotiate to conclusion for nuclear disarmament in all its aspects under strict and effective international control. That's practically a quote. That's unanimous. Well, that means that it is illegal for the United States government to stockpile nuclear weapons. It is illegal to make new kinds of nuclear weapons. It's illegal to threaten to use nuclear weapons. And that is one of the violations by this administration. It didn't start with this administration, but it continues.
Mm-hmm. I want to just briefly ask you a related question about the area that you mentioned that includes the right of prisoners not to be tortured with the recent vote of the Senate related to that issue. Will that affect what you're doing, or how do you see that in the general scheme of things?
Well, let's go back to the beginning. Of course, any time the House or the Senate upholds the law, it's a good thing. But just to be clear, the Eighth Amendment says there shall be no cruel and unusual punishment. And it doesn't say to whom it applies. It applies to everybody. No cruel and unusual punishment. And then in 1945, the United States ratified the United Nations Charter. That's another treaty. And it says the United Nations shall promote universal respect for and observance of fundamental human rights and freedoms for all without distinction as to race, sex, language, or religion. Well, torture is obviously included as violation. And Article 56 says all member nations shall do what it says in Article 55. So the United States is supposed to be promoting universal respect. And then in 1994, we ratified this treaty that says it is called the International Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment. And under that treaty, we agreed not to do those things, and we agreed to make a report every so many years, every 3 years. Well, we didn't do that. We owed a report in 1995. Instead, we issued the first report in 2000. And finally, this May, we issued a second report. And in the second report, which did not cover all kinds of torture that have happened, that are covered in this book, and they had a copy of this book because I sent it to them, so if there's no excuse. I'm not saying this is the only thing they had. But not only did they not cover everything else, but they said what's happening in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo is none of your business. That is, it's none of the business of an international committee that enforces a treaty that's been signed by nations. Well, there's no way to explain why it is not the business of the committee. And the committee was angry, I'm convinced. And what then happened is the UN Human Rights Commission, which is a different body. There's something called the UN Human Rights Committee, something called the UN Human Rights Commission, but it's a different body. The UN Human Rights Commission was so angry that they then appointed a special rapporteur on human rights violations in the fight against terrorism. And it's aimed at the U.S. explicitly. Mm-hmm. And so the world as a whole is very angry at what the United States government is doing today. I was just on a book tour in Paris, London, Brussels, and Toulouse. And wherever I went, among U.S. citizens who live abroad, permanently live there and have many friends and husbands and relatives who are from those countries, they are furious at what the U.S. is doing. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how much news KABU is able to give to your listeners, but the fact is there's more news about violations of human rights in Europe than there is coverage in the U.S. And this book is an effort, in part, to meet that problem.
What would you like to see happen to these records of the human rights violations by the U.S. since 9/11?
Well, I'd like many things, and one thing has happened, I'm very proud to say, it just happened this last week. It's very exciting. The United States government owed a report to the UN Human Rights Committee in 1998, which they didn't issue, their second report. They owed a report in 2003, a third report, which they didn't issue. But last Friday, they issued a combined second and third report. And I can't prove it has anything to do with this book, but we did send this book to the State Department last March, and we sent when it first came out, and we sent copies to everybody on the Human Rights Committee. And so this past week in Geneva, a judge from Detroit, Michigan, Claudia Morcom, who was a retired circuit court judge, went to the UN Human Rights Committee at their request, representing Mickeljohn Institute and the National Lawyers Guild and the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, to talk about violations of human rights because in the U.S., by the U.S., because the U.S. hadn't filed its report. And so last Friday, the U.S. government filed its second report.
How was it? Did you see it?
Well, thank you for asking. I know that it was filed because I learned it not from the State Department. I learned it from the UN Human Rights Committee in Geneva. And so immediately I asked for a copy. Well, it turns out that the UN has a rule. You think it's difficult running a KABU station in Portland in one language or maybe two languages. every document that is submitted to the UN has to be translated into five more languages, because there are six basic languages. So the UN cannot issue a report that's given to them in English until it's been translated into Chinese, Russian, French, Spanish, and Arabic. Well, that hasn't happened yet. So obviously, though, this is a public document by the State Department. So you call up the State Department, say, maybe we have a copy, please. And you get on the phone, and they tell you, oh, I don't know about that. I'll have to call you back and tell you who to talk to. And this is in the Department of Communications for the State Department. Hours later, they call you back, and they tell you to call a certain number. You call that number and leave a message, and they never call you back. And you spend literally an enormous amount of time with the U.S. State Department, when you speak English and you know what you're talking about, to find out. And they say, oh, yes, we're putting it on the web today. And it's not on the web. And somebody at the State Department even said, maybe it isn't going to be a public document. Well, how could it not be a public document when it's a statement report by the United States government to the UN Human Rights Committee? So I know that it's 250 pages long. And I know from the man at the State Department I finally spoke to, although he didn't write it, that it does say something about Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. I don't know what it says. Mm-hmm. But the reason they had to do it was we sent this report, and there were many other groups. And so in August, for the first time in history, the UN Human Rights Committee sent us an email, and they sent it to the American Civil Liberties Union and to the Human Rights Organization International, it's called, and said, since we haven't gotten the U.S. second report and we haven't got the U.S. third report, we have decided that at our meeting we want a report on what's happening in the United States, and we don't want a report on every segment of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. We just want three things. We want to know what has happened, the implications of the Patriot Act since 9/11 on human rights. What about the detention since 9/11? And what about the treatment of prisoners? And so we sent them reports. Now, as it turned out, of the 180 reports, 71 are about these issues. So we sent them the 71 reports, and they thanked us. And then Judge Claudia Morcom of Detroit went to Geneva and made an oral report. And she was so effective that they asked her to come back, because we've since then discovered the terrible human rights violations going on by the federal government in relation to Katrina. Outrageous violations based on the race and poverty of the people. And so they asked her to come back and specifically talk about Katrina, which was not their original intent. And just for anybody who's critical of the UN, and anyone can be, it's a huge organization, but you can be critical of one piece of it, like Haiti, but without being critical of the thing as a whole. But in any case, the UN somehow managed to send what they call a special rapporteur to New Orleans, and he's the special rapporteur on extreme poverty. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem. In New Orleans, the people with extreme poverty are being treated as if they are nothing.
Do you want to elaborate just a bit more on that? I know we're not going into it in detail in this interview, but just on the issue of violations as a result of Katrina.
Absolutely. There were people who got on a bridge in order to cross over while their homes and areas were being destroyed. And they got on a bridge to cross over into a safe area, and they were met by guns. And the government in that area did nothing, and the FEMA did nothing, and the National Guard did nothing to stop them. And there were people who were not picked up from the poor neighborhoods, black and poor neighborhoods, or African-American and poverty-stricken white. They were not picked up. And to many people who are religious, and that is a very deeply religious community in New Orleans, to leave a dead body lying in mud for 10 days when the body has been pointed out to National Guard members is not only lacking in human dignity, it is a fundamental violation of the most basic principles. Right at this moment, I got a call this morning because there are law students who went to the law school in New Orleans who are now going in Houston to Tulane. It's moved there for this semester. And apparently what has happened is that landlords in New Orleans are evicting tenants because they haven't paid their rent for the past 2 months when they were not there. And they are raising the rents in that area. And FEMA employees are coming in to take those apartments at higher rents. So that the effort is to destroy the parts of New Orleans as places where people can live who are African American, which is the majority in New Orleans, and if they are poor, and that is being done with the connivance or with the agreement of FEMA. When you send in National Guard troops from all over the country, they know nothing about the culture. Have you ever been to New Orleans?
No.
Well, if you went there, you'd know you're in a different place. Mm. I mean, it is not the same as the rest of the United States. There is a Creole feeling to it. There's an African-American feeling. There's a French feeling. It is not the same as going to Portland or San Francisco. And the beauty of the National Guard is that it's local. And if the local National Guard people of New Orleans were there, they would not be tending to treat the people of New Orleans as if they were strange or whatever else. And the National Guard has come in there with guns when the people couldn't get out because they said, drive out. People had no cars. Hundreds and thousands of people had no cars. You don't do that. And lies were told also about how many people had looted. And lies were told about how many people were raped or damaged in the Coliseum. And I got into all of this because there's something called the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond, which is an African-American organization with white membership as well, fighting against racism. And their main office was in New Orleans. Well, it was destroyed. And so one of the people from that institute lives in Berkeley. He works on anti-racism meetings. And he and I met. We started talking. And that's how we made this list of 18 violations of the laws of the United States being committed at this moment by the president, by the FEMA, by the National Guard, by the Army that has come in there, by the FBI, all totally in violation of the concept of human dignity.
I'm speaking with Ann Fagan Ginger, and the title of the book that we've been talking about is Challenging U.S. Human Rights Violations Since 9/11. I wanted to mention that the Mickeljohn Civil Liberties Institute is the group that put this out, and Ann is the executive director of that group. I don't think I mentioned that before.
Well, actually, it's a Prometheus book, but Mickeljohn Institute is the, I guess you would say, is the source, and I edited the material.
And
I just might add that John Conyers thinks it's a good book, Congressman Conyers, and Noam Chomsky, and Howard Zinn.
Wow.
They're on
Can't
the
Can't beat those for blurbs. So I know that you have some actions going that relate to cities and the violations of human rights. Can you talk about that campaign a little bit?
Sure. I was appointed to something called the Berkeley City Commission on Peace and Justice, which is an organization of the city to enforce a nuclear-free zone ordinance and take up other peace and justice issues. And suddenly it occurred to me that the UN Charter is part of the law of Berkeley, and none of the people in City Hall know about it. So I took Article 55, which I mentioned to you before, the United Nations shall promote human, so forth, and I just took out the word United Nations and put in the word City of Berkeley. In Article 56, it says that all the nations shall work together. So I said the city shall work with the county, the state, and the United States, and the UN. And I suggested, and the Human Rights Commission voted, Peace and Justice Commission voted to that this should be an ordinance. And we gave it to the city council. And the city attorney said, what does all this mean? And I said, I don't know, but doesn't it sound nice? And it sounded very nice. This was in 1990. So the city of Berkeley now has the Human Rights Ordinance number such and so of the city of Berkeley in the same exact language as Article 55 and 56. And in fact, it is already the law of Portland or any city or state of Oregon, but people don't know it. Well, once we passed that ordinance, then when the war in Iraq began, the city council passed a resolution opposing the war in Iraq based on the Human Rights Ordinance. And since that time, there have been one after another, the Patriot Act, you can think of many issues that have come up where it really is a violation of Article 55 and 56 of the UN Charter, but it's much more convenient and appropriate and more right in your face if you say it's a violation of the Human Rights Ordinance. And today, when one of these decisions is made, that, for example, against the war in Iraq, it's very common to say send a copy to the President, the Department of Defense, and the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights in Geneva. And because of that ordinance, the people in City Hall, the mayor, the council members, and the ordinary people who work in City Hall know that in addition to Berkeley being in the city and the county and the state and the U.S., that we're part of something called the United Nations. It makes it much more real. And so my suggestion is that the people in Portland do the same thing, that you adopt the Article 55 and 56 or adopt part of the Torture Convention, or all of it, or adopt the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. In many cities, many women are working to adopt the Convention on Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. You've probably heard about that campaign. And I think that's important. I would suggest that even more important is adopting Article 55, because it says no distinction based on race, sex, language, or religion. So in a sense, you've covered what is now in what's called CEDAW. And I'm all for CEDAW, but I think in the meantime, those rights are also covered in the other treaties. And I think it's unfortunate that not more people realize that. The other thing, which is, I think, you might say hilarious, there's something called the Convention on the Rights of the Child. Mm-hmm. Do you know how many nations have not ratified that in the whole world?
No.
Make a guess. There are 189 nations. Guess how many have not ratified the Convention on the Rights of the Child?
30.
One. Do you know what the one is?
Oh, I can guess now.
Yes, it's the United States. And this is an outrage, and very few people are aware of it. So what I'm really trying to hope that the cities and counties will do is that they'll get involved in this process. The first thing is to read the treaties and see what they contain. The second thing is to start telling City Hall and the department that's in charge of prisons, the department that's in the district attorney's office, the welfare rights or welfare division, housing, education, look in this treaty. You're covered. And you have to make a report. And under the treaty, the every city and county and state is required to make a report to the State Department, which the State Department gives in its report to Geneva. Now, when I talked to this man from the State Department yesterday, when I finally got him on the phone, I said, does your second report to the UN Human Rights Committee contain reports from the states? He said, oh, it's impossible to get reports from the states. I said, did you ask them? He said, well, we asked them in the past, and it was difficult. That isn't what it says in the treaty. It says you shall do it. Mm. Well, if he asked them in the past and they didn't ask him this time, that's wrong. But the other fact is you folks, anybody in any city can say to their city, make a report. And that's what we did in Berkeley. After we got the Human Rights Ordinance adopted, I went to the city council and said, it seems to me the Commission on the Status, we have commissions in Berkeley, Commission on the Status of Women, Commission on Youth, the Commission on Labor, the Police Review Commission, should all make reports that should go in the U.S. report that goes to the U.N. And they did. So those commissions learned the process. And it could be done in any city or any state. And by law, it's required. The second and all future reports have to be at the state and local level. So it gives a wonderful opportunity for any active person to go to City Hall or the Board of Education and say, I'm giving you copies of the three treaties. Please read, see how they apply to, and then write a report. Mm. And let us see the report and also give it to the State Department and to the UN Human Rights Committee. And then that is how changes have taken place. And what I often tell people is the UN may be far away and it doesn't have an army of its own, doesn't have a big budget. But you ask Nelson Mandela, and he will tell you he would still be in prison today, despite the heroism of the South African people who fought for him, if there hadn't also been a movement in the United Nations. And the people of East Timor would not have a separate nation today if it hadn't been for the work within the United Nations. So it's arrogance on our part when we have problems in Portland on any issue or in Berkeley or wherever else, not to realize that we are part of a system of law which we helped write, the United States helped write it, that we can make use of.
Ann Fagan Ginger, I want to thank you very much for talking about these issues and telling us about some actions that we can take here in Portland. Thank you so much. And I want to let people know that you will be speaking at Laughing Horse Books Friday evening at 7 p.m., speaking and also signing copies of the book. Is that right?
Sure.
And also you'll be part of a Women in Black action on Friday at noon at Pioneer Square, I believe.
At
Terry Shrunk Plaza. Thank you. At Terry Shrunk Plaza. And is there anything else that you think is important to say as we wrap up this interview?
Well, I may sound rather serious or frantic or something else, and I would just say two things. One is that this is the first time in the history of the world that one nation was capable of destroying all life on the planet, either through nuclear weapons or through environmental policy. And so if everyone who has worked their heads off for social change or for justice all their lives, and they continue to do what they've been doing, we will fail. Mm. What we have to do is find new paths for action, and that's the reason I'm talking in the way that I am. I'm very hopeful if people will think new thoughts about how to accomplish what we've been working on so far, we can make a difference.
Thank you again. Ann Fagan Ginger, the title of the book is Challenging U.S. Human Rights Violations Since 9/11. Thank you again.
You're welcome.
This is Kathleen Stevenson for the Radio Zine.
I should have probably said our webpage.
Oh, okay. Well, let's add it. I can put it in there. And for people who want more information on this material?
We have a webpage, www.mcli.org. M is in Mickle John, mcli.org.
Okay, great.